Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka with another episode from Sri Aurobindo, Synthesis of Yoga. These are the conditions of our effort, and they point to an ideal which can be expressed in these or in equivalent formulae. To live in God and not in the ego. To move, vastly founded, not in the little egoistic consciousness, but in the consciousness of the all soul and the transcendent. To be perfectly equal in all happenings and to all beings, and to see and feel them as one with oneself and one with the divine, to feel all in oneself and all in God, to feel God in all and oneself in all. To act in God and not in the ego. And here, first, not to choose action by reference to personal needs and standards, but in obedience to the dictates of the living highest truth above us. Next, as soon as we are sufficiently founded in the spiritual consciousness, not to act any longer by our separate will or movement, but more and more to allow action to happen, and develop under the impulsion and guidance of a divine will that surpasses us. And last, the supreme result, to be exalted into an identity in knowledge, force, consciousness, act, joy of existence with the divine Shakti, and to feel a dynamic movement not dominated by mortal desire and vital instinct and impulse and elusive mental free will, but luminously conceived and evolved in an immortal self-delight and an infinite self-knowledge. For this is the action that comes by a conscious subjection and merging of the natural man into the divine self and eternal spirit. It is the spirit that forever transcends and guides this world nature. But by what practical steps of self-discipline can we arrive at such a consummation? The elimination of all egoistic activity and its foundation, the egoistic consciousness, is clearly the key to consummation we desire. And since in the path of works, action is the knot we have first to loosen, we must endeavor to loosen it where it is centrally tied, in desire, in ego. For otherwise, we shall cut only stray strands and not the heart of our bondage. These are the two knots of our subjection to this ignorant and divided nature, desire and ego sense. And of these two, desire has its native home in the emotions and sensations and instincts, and from there affects thought and volition. Ego sense lives indeed in these movements, but it casts its deep roots also in the thinking mind and its will, and it is there that it becomes fully self-conscious. These are the twin obscure powers of the obsessing worldwide ignorance that we have to enlighten and eliminate. In the field of action, desire takes many forms, but the most powerful of all is the vital self's craving or seeking after the fruit of our works. The fruit we covet may be a reward of internal pleasure. It may be the accomplishment of some preferred idea or some cherished will or the satisfaction of the egotistic emotions, or else the pride of success of our highest hopes and ambitions. Or it may be an external reward, a recompense entirely material, wealth, position, honor, victory, good fortune, or any other fulfillment of vital or physical desire. But all alike are lures by which egoism holds us. Always these satisfactions delude us with sense of mastery and the idea of freedom, while really we are harnessed and guided or ridden and whipped by some gross or subtle, some noble or ignoble figure of the blind desire that drives the world. Therefore, the first rule of action laid down by the Gita is to do the work that should be done without any desire for the fruit. Nishkama karma. A simple rule in appearance, and yet how difficult to carry out with anything like an absolute sincerity and liberating entireness. In the greater part of our action, we use the principle very little, if at all, and then even mostly as a sort of counterpoise to the normal principle of desire and to mitigate the extreme action of that tyrant impulse. At best, we are satisfied if we arrive at a modified and disciplined egoism, not too shocking to our moral sense and not too brutally offensive to others. And to our partial self-discipline, we give various names and forms. We habituate ourselves by practice to the sense of duty, to a firm fidelity to principle, a stoical fortitude or a religious resignation, a quiet or an ecstatic submission to God's will. But it is not these things that the Gita intends, useful though they are in their place. It aims at something absolute, unmitigated, uncompromising, a turn, an attitude that will change the whole poise of the soul. Not the mind's control of vital impulse is its rule, but the strong immobility of an immortal spirit. The test it lays down is an absolute equality of the mind and the heart to all results, to all reactions, to all happenings. If good fortune and ill fortune, if respect and insult, if reputation and obloquy, if victory and defeat, if pleasant event and sorrowful event leave us not only unshaken, but untouched, free in the emotions, free in the nervous reactions, free in the mental view, not responding with the least disturbance or vibration in any spot of the nature, then we have the absolute liberation to which the Gita points us, but not otherwise. The tiniest reaction is a proof that the discipline is imperfect and that some part of us accepts ignorance and bondage as its law and clings still to the old nature. Our self-conquest is only partially accomplished. It is still imperfect or unreal in some stretch or part or smallest spot of the ground of our nature. And that little pebble of imperfection may throw down the entire achievement of the yoga. There are certain semblances of an equal spirit which must not be mistaken for the profound and vast spiritual equality which the Gita teaches. There is an equality of disappointed resignation, an equality of pride, an equality of hardness and indifference. All these are egoistic in their nature. Inevitably, they come in the course of the sadhana, but they must be rejected or transformed into the true quietude. There is too, on a higher level, the equality of the stoic, the equality of a devout resignation or a sage detachment, the equality of a soul aloof from the world and indifferent to its doings. But these two are insufficient. First approaches they can be, but they are at most early soul phases only, or imperfect mental preparations for our entry into the true and absolute self-existent wide evenness of the spirit. It is certain that so great a result cannot be arrived at immediately and without any previous stages. At first, we have to learn to bear the shocks of the world with the central part of our being untouched and silent. Even when the surface mind, heart, life are strongly shaken, unmoved there on the bedrock of our life, we must separate the soul watching behind or immune deep within from these outer workings of our nature. Afterwards, extending this calm and steadfastness of the detached soul to its instruments, it will become slowly possible to radiate peace from the luminous center to the darker peripheries. In this process, we may take the passing help of many minor phases, a certain stoicism, a certain calm philosophy. Even a certain religious exaltation may help us towards some nearness to our aim. Or we may call in even less strong and exalted, but still useful powers of our mental nature. But in the end, we must either discard or transform them and arrive instead at an entire equality, a perfect self-existent peace within, and even if we can, a total unassailable, self-poised, and spontaneous delight in all our members. But how then shall we continue to act at all? For ordinarily, the human being acts because he has a desire or feels a mental, vital, or physical want or need. He is driven by the necessities of the body, by the lust of riches, honors, fame, craving for the personal satisfactions of the mind or the heart, or a craving for power or pleasure. Or he is seized and pushed about by a moral need, or at least the need of the desire of making his ideas or his ideals or his will or his party or his country or his gods prevail. If none of these desires, or any other, must be the spring of our action, it would seem as if all incentive or motive power had been removed, and action itself must necessarily cease. The Gita replies with its third great secret of the divine life. All action must be done in a more and more Godward, and finally a God-possessed consciousness. Our works must be a sacrifice to the divine, and in the end, a surrender of all our being, mind, will, heart, sense, life, and body to the One. It must make God love and God service our only motive. This seems like a pretty good place to pause for today. We will continue with the next episode. And we thank you for listening to Oroville Radio. May light guide your day. Signing off, Marlenka. Bye.
This is Oroville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.